I had a pretty good season, you know, and not a single team called me to be on their team or anything like that.
No way.
So like, well, if I haven't made it yet, like, I'm not gonna make it. I've definitely spent a couple of months struggling to sleep. You know, you're like, every night you're like, oh my god, what am I gonna do? Like, is this over? He was. If I'm gonna be honest with you, Iago, I have no idea who you are. I was like, okay, fair enough. He's like, so you need to convince me that I should sponsor you. Everybody thinks that Enduro is not in a great spot, but the good thing about that is that everybody is thinking about how to make it better. I started getting that really, really bad headache. Like this pressure was like in my head, and I could feel like my heartbeat through that headache. I heard her say, like, I think he's got a brain aneurysm. We need to get him to the hospital immediately.
Whoa.
I was fighting for my life, you know?
Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we're going to be taking you deeper than ever into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. Exciting news, folks. Seven Mesh are back supporting the podcast, and they've got a very generous offer in store for you, the Downtime listeners. I'm a longtime fan of Seven Mesh, whose commitment to crafting top quality, innovative mountain bike clothing is second to none. I've talked to in the past about how amazing and versatile their Chilcoat Anorak is, and this winter, my standout piece of Seven Mesh kit has been their new grip pants, which utilize their in-house developed air mat material technology. Let me tell you, the grip pants are an absolute game changer. They're water resistant enough that they're going to shrug off a shower, and they definitely stop the spray from the trail getting you wet. Yet, the air permeable sections mean they breathe way better than any waterproof pants I've ever worn, so there's none of that horrible boil in the bag feeling. As a result, the grip pants have been my trusty sidekick for the majority of rides this winter and spring. And with the arrival of spring, what better time to treat yourself to some fresh riding gear? Seven Mesh have just unveiled their mountain bike collection for spring-summer 2024 over on sevenmesh.com, and they're offering an exclusive 20% discount to all Downtime listeners. The new lineup boasts a vibrant array of new colours, as well as an updated version of their fan favourite GlidePath pant. GlidePath is a lightweight, pedal-friendly trail pant designed for maximum comfort, along with a DWR coating to help them repel water. Having spent ample time in the previous version, I can attest to their outstanding lightness and comfort, making them a perfect trail pant. I'll personally be putting the new GlidePath pants through their paces this week, and I'll let you know how I get on. So if you're ready to elevate your riding experience this spring and summer, head over to 7mesh.com. That's the number 7 followed by the word mesh.com, and use the code DOWNTIMEX7MESH20 to enjoy a generous 20% off. That's downtime, all lowercase, the letter X, the number 7, M-E-S-H, and then the number 20, all one word, over at 7mesh.com. But hurry, this offer is only valid until April the 10th, 2024. All right, just a couple of quick things before we get stuck into this episode. First up, make sure you never miss an episode by following the podcast. Just hit the follow button in your podcast app now, or find dedicated buttons for all major platforms at downtimepodcast.com/follow. You can also keep up to date with what's going on by following us on Instagram or Facebook, where we're at Downtime Podcast. And if you're hungry for more downtime, then join the newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter for exclusive behind the scenes insights, mountain biking snippets, product reviews, partner offers and more. If you want to support the show, then you can join our Patreon over at downtimepodcast.com/Patreon, or grab yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop. If you prefer to watch today's episode, you can check out the podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast. I'd love it if you head over there, subscribe to the channel, and show the video some love via likes and comments. It's been fun hanging in the chat with some of you during the weekly episode premieres on the channel too, so thanks to everyone who's shown up. All the links that I've mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode on the website downtimepodcast.com. All right, today I'm joined by one of the most stylish enduro riders on the planet, Iago Garry. Iago's story is one of passion, perseverance, hard work and dedication. In this episode, we'll explore the pivotal moments that shaped Iago's journey, from his introduction to mountain biking to his unique story of how he turned professional and got his big break. We'll also dive into the future of enduro racing, gaining valuable insights from Iago's unique and positive perspective as a seasoned competitor. But perhaps most importantly, we'll discuss Iago's incredible resilience in the face of adversity, including his recent battle with a brain aneurysm. Through all of it, Iago's unwavering spirit and love for the sport have remained unbreakable, serving as an inspiration to riders around the world. This is a conversation you won't want to miss. So, without further ado, here's Iago Garry. Iago Garay, welcome to the Downtime Podcast, man. It's been a little while making this happen. We've chatted about it a couple of times when I've seen your events, but good to finally get you on. How's things?
It's good, man. Yeah, thanks for having me. I guess we've bumped into each other a lot of times, and I think we were trying to make it happen in person, eh? But like, it's complicated.
It's hard, yeah, making sure we're both at events. And normally if you're at an event, then you're pretty hectic with riding, racing, practicing and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, maybe yeah. Better doing it remote. And we've not had you on the show before, so we'll get a bit of a full background on you. And I did a bit of digging around, and there's a link to a pink bike in your very early riding history, apparently, a shop that you went to with your parents, I think maybe to fix a lawnmower, and ended up getting obsessed with a bike that you saw there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's, I guess that was my first bike. We were the little apartment we had in the mountains, well, a studio, more like a tiny thing. And we went to grab something from the hardware store that in the town is like hardware store, bike shop, and like everything really. And they do anything. And they had a little bike. Sat down on the shop floor with like the training wheels and everything. And while we were waiting for them to get whatever they were looking for, I jumped on it and started pedaling around. And by the time it was time to leave, I was like, I wouldn't get off it. I was like, no, I'm not getting off. So I just had to buy it. And and I basically rode the bike out of the shop straight up.
That's cool. And, so you knew early on somewhere deep down that the bikes were going to be part of your life. And your dad rode a little bit, right? He used to sort of take you out a bit of cross country and out into the mountains a bit.
Yeah. So my dad and my mom, they've always been like, really outdoorsy and to a very like chill level, you know, like they just loved being outside. And my dad's always been a mountaineer. He's always like done a lot of skiing and paragliding and climbing and hiking and all of this stuff. So for them, I think it was in the early days, it was easy to take me on bike rides. We're not going to go paragliding or climb a gnarly rock face or anything like that. Mountain biking was our main family activity, you know, that we'll spend our weekends just going on cool XC loops and, you know, pack a lunch and have a picnic somewhere and stuff. Like, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, nice. And was there a competitive element to your parents' kind of use of the outdoors, or were they purely, like you say, more on the chill side?
Yeah, no. So surprisingly, like, my family is zero competitive. Like, and my dad, I think, maybe entered like 4 or 5 races in his life. Mainly skiing. Uh-huh. Biking was never a competitive aspect. We were always just like just doing something outside, you know. For me, it was kind of like an interesting transition. Like, it didn't even come from me or from my parents, like the fact of going racing. It was suggested by some friends. We joined like a club from one of the biggest bike shops in Spain, uh-huh, called Bicimania. And they had a huge downhill team, so they were going to all the races around the country and stuff. And one day they mentioned, hey, like, there is this bike race in a couple of weeks, and they have a kids specific category, so you guys should go try it, because like, it's gonna be really fun. And I was like, wait, there is a sport that is only going downhill? Like, I haven't heard about this, you know? Because obviously, as a kid, you're not very strong. Like, your least favorite part is obviously the climbing.
Yeah.
And it was funny because back then, my dad and I had a Cannondale tandem. So, like a two-person mountain bicycle. And my mom would come with us in her own bike, obviously. And every time we got to the top of a climb, I would try to convince my mom to swap spots with me. So I would take her bike down and she would go down on the tandem. And that was like my favorite part. So yeah, when they told me that that was a sport in itself, I was like, I want to try that.
Hell yeah.
So yeah, we went to that race, and it was super, super fun for me. I got on the podium straight away. I think there was 3 kids and I got second or something like that.
So awesome. Was it a Maxis Cup or something? It was quite a big race.
Yeah. So it was a Maxis International cut race. So in a ski resort in the north of Spain, back then when those races were epic, they were basically like the European series. Yeah. And it was funny because I got there obviously knowing nothing about sport or whatever. I like saw everybody heading up on the chairlift to go practice. Like, oh, right. So I'll get my bike, get on the chairlift, get to the top, start riding down. And I was on like a hardtail 24-inch kit bike with like this much suspension. Like, I don't know, like it had a fork, but it didn't really do much. V-brakes and everything. And I start going down. And I crashed like 5 or 6 times. I don't know. It was so gnarly. It was a proper, like, it could have been back there at World Cup track, I imagine. Cool. And got to the bottom, and my dad was like, how was it? I was like, oh, it was sick. It was so good. Like, I want to go up again. and then somebody comes like, wait, you went to the top of the mountain? And we're like, yeah. Like, no. The kids race right there, like that little hill. It was like a grassy hill where they just put like a couple of gates, and it was like more like a 30-second track or something. I was like, oh, okay.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. So I think my dad was super stoked that I was like so into like a sport, because back then like it was just more like it was a family thing, and I was more kind of getting dragged into the bike rides than me like being like, hey, come on guys, let's go ride, you know. And it was a super cool atmosphere, you know. Everybody was so friendly, and we made so many friends just on the first weekend. That from then on, like basically every weekend for the rest of the year, we were on a bike race. It was sick.
That's cool. And were you obviously like second place as a kid, you're going to be pretty stoked with that. But were you there because you were enjoying the competitive element, or because you liked the camaraderie and the ability to like take part in these events and have fun? Like, what was it that kept you coming back?
I think it was a bit of everything. Obviously, when you're good at something, you enjoy doing it even more, right? So, for someone that had never probably done like, I don't know, like a kids run, like run race, and I had done like, I don't know, like just some silly things. So I hadn't been really tried competition at all.
Okay.
So I think trying competition in like a more serious way and like being good at it, it was definitely a motivator. But like I said, like going downhill with bikes was my favorite. It was my favorite sport without me even knowing it was a sport. So I think it was a bit of everything. Just it was really cool. You know, you get to, it's not only like the riding and stuff, like for me, like being able to go to a different spot every weekend, it was sick. Like I've always really enjoyed traveling a lot. Mm-hmm. And my mother is a flight attendant, so she used to take me with her on like on her flights and trips and stuff. So I've always been like someone that's really used to traveling. So I think that aspect also really was really, really interesting to me. And yeah, it make it fun, you know, like there wasn't a routine. The routine was that you were going to a different place every weekend. So that was really cool.
That is cool, man. And you know, some races you hear, like they get so stuck into it early on, they sort of sack off schooling and focus just on the racing, but you carried on with your schooling, right? What was it that you studied? Was it sports science?
Yeah. So, my dad, I think he probably like knew that could be an option, you know, like wanting to drop out of school or whatever. And always from day one, the number one rule to go to the race in the weekends, like you cannot fail a single class.
Okay.
So it was, I mean, it's not that I was bad in school. I was a good student, like not outstanding, but like, I've never had problems really. Like, I kept all through school and high school, and then it obviously went through my mind that not going to university, because obviously the dream was to be a professional rider and like go on race World Cups, down to World Cups and stuff. But my last year of high school, obviously my last year as a junior, like I did a couple World Cups. I went to World Champs. I got second on the European Downhill Champs and stuff. And I was like, fuck, I had a pretty good season, you know? And not a single team called me to be on their team or anything like that.
No
way. So like, well, if I haven't made it yet, like I'm not going to make it. So I better get studying, you know?
fair play. And so, your studies like allowed you to travel a little bit as well, right? Which kind of worked for you. You obviously had that bug for travel.
Yeah. So the cool part about when I got second at the European Championships, there's I got introduced into a program from the Spanish government that is like the elite athlete program.
Okay.
So it kind of it's usually more about Olympic sports, but I think kind of because it was in mountain biking and like the we had a federation that had Olympic sports, but not. I got introduced into this program, and basically it puts you in a category where like you can ask for scholarships, you can have help with your studies. I even got it was called like a tutor, like someone that I could speak with from the Spanish government, well, work for the government. Mm-hmm. That if I needed to change any exam, so I needed something from a teacher, they would call the teacher and they will ask them, you know, to see if they can make it happen. And lucky for me, I was studying sports science. So obviously anything sports related, all the teachers would take it a little bit more serious than probably another class. And if they got called from like the Olympic committee, I don't know what exactly was, but they're all like, they always like helped me and they allowed me to change that. And yeah, like I said, I always loved traveling. So one thing I had clear is like, okay, I'm going to study, but I'm going to try and have the best time possible, you know? And so from the first day I was in university, my plan was to apply to all of the exchange programs that I could to live in other countries. Uh-huh. So you have to do at least 3 years in your first school in Spain to be able to start moving countries and stuff. So I did the first 3 years. And then I applied for a scholarship to go to America to study there for a year. So I got that, and I went to the Northern Kentucky University near Cincinnati. And while I was there, I applied for another scholarship to go to Germany with Erasmus, and I also got that one. So I went straight from America to Germany. And yeah, it was really cool. And actually, like, I think that's one of the main things that helped me reach the point in my career where I started to be a professional writer, surprisingly for me.
Interesting.
By being in America, you know, I was just using every penny that I had to go race for fun, like not looking to become professional or anything like that. I was just like, well, I'm in America. I want to enjoy this. I want to travel. I want to ride around here and check out how races are over here and allow me to travel. I decided to go to Sea Otter because I've always, you know, always grown up seeing on the magazines and on the internet and stuff. I was like, oh, that'd be so cool. And I got to meet a lot of people over there from companies and stuff. And I spoke with them, and I had printed my own little like personal CVs with some photos and some results and stuff. And I was handing them out to them, like, really just looking for some product support, I didn't have to spend so much money on my racing. And I got to meet a lot of the you know, the main marketing people from those brands, that they were really, really interested in what I was doing. Cool. Like, I think maybe they haven't had that many people from Spain, definitely not from Spain, and maybe not from Europe, just come out to there and, you know, and like speak to them and stuff. So I got to meet a lot of brands that I'm still working from. I'm still working with right now. It was really cool. Like people from Camelback and Cram Brothers. After I spoke with them, they were like, of course, whatever you need. And then from there, they started building out their relationship. And yeah, that would have been, I think that would have been like 2013. No, earlier. That would have been like 2012 or something like that. So yeah.
That's amazing.
More than 10 years.
Yeah.
With those companies.
What do you think they saw in you when you had those conversations? Do you think it was the fact that you were making the effort to be there doing that stuff and you were just like so excited to be there and racing? Do you think it was like, you've obviously always been a stylish rider, like you know you photograph and film really well, which is great from a brand perspective. Like, I guess you had some decent results behind you at that point, but probably not like incredible, like you weren't, you know, winning World Cup downhills and stuff. But like, yeah, what do you think it was that brands kind of connected with? Because it sounds like it was an instant, like, good start to relationships.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a combination of everything. I mean, back then, I think people used to do more of this. You know, it was more traditional to just, every rider would go to Eurobike show or Sea Otter or whatever and go trying to, like, meet sponsors and try and get sponsored in person. While I guess it's not so much nowadays where people just wait for people to come to them. Like, I think the fact that you're out there, like, putting, you know, like spending your own money to get all the way there from Spain, that you've put the effort into like creating your own presentation, your CV, speaking about them and obviously I had some, back then I was doing a lot of maxi avalanche and mega avalanche events. Like I had been doing them since like they started allowing me, because I was too young when I wanted to do them. So I had good results in that. And by then I had started taking some, like doing photo shoots with some photographer friends. So I had like some really good photos to show to people. And so yeah, obviously a combination of everything, you know, I think being European and able to speak good English with those people, like, you know, communicating is very important. Yeah. And then, yeah, I think it's just, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm not really sure. I think, yeah, just trying to putting the effort, you know, putting the effort of trying to get the attention from those companies and you know, being friendly, having a good image, trying to look like a professional, even though I was not. It definitely helped me in the long run.
Yeah, good on you, man. And obviously, like Santa Cruz is a kind of a big formative part of your career. You spent a good chunk of time with them. Was that a connection that you made while you're out in the US as well?
Yeah, that was interesting. It was nothing I actually, it didn't happen during Sea Otter, but back then I was riding for Trek Bikes through the Spanish distributor, and they had been supporting me for like, I think it was like 7 years or something. But then they had some internal changes. The main guy I had been dealing with for those, the whole time swapped, and then like the relationship got a little bit worse. And while I was in America, I had a family friend that told me, hey, if you ever need anything, I have this guy I know from Santa Cruz Bikes that he can help you if you need anything. And I was like, oh, cool. That's thanks that. But like, I'm riding for Trek, so I don't really need anything right now. And then a couple of months later, I was like, oh, you know what? Can I speak with your friend Santa Cruz? Because, you know, like it's not going so well. So I spoke with him, and it was really funny because I got on a call and I was speaking and I was telling him like, hey, yeah, like I'm looking for a bike and looking for some support because I want to keep doing some races and this and that. And the guy, his name was Mariano. He was, if I'm going to be honest with you, Iago, I have no idea who you are. I was like, okay, fair enough. He's like, so you need to convince me that I should sponsor you. And I was like, oh, look, well, I've done all of this and I'm planning on doing some national World Cups and some, that was the year the Enduro was starting. So I was like, I'm going to try this Enduro World Series stuff. And the guy was like, okay, well, I'm going to lend you a couple bikes. You know, he was like, you can borrow them. And then by the end of the season, you'll have to hand them back. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Yeah. You know, like, two Santa Cruz bikes for me to race on? That's sick. Didn't sound Mariano. He was, he had gone to the same high school as me.
No way.
And it was from Madrid, but he had moved. He was living in America and he was the global sales manager for Santa Cruz. So, pretty big dog out there. And, he had a pretty like blind faith, I would say, you know, like he relied on like his friend, our mutual friend that vouched for me and trusted that I was going to be a good investment. And then I got back from America and went to do a couple of races, and I went to Mega Avalanche and I had my best ever race. And like, it was my second race in the Santa Cruz, and I finished, I think it was eighth or ninth overall. And I was the first amateur racer. Everybody else were pro. And, you know, it was 2013, so the Enduro world was starting to emerge, and the day after that I got a call from Mariano, and he was like, hey, I've just had a meeting with Rob Ruscope and Will from marketing, and we were speaking about you, and if you're coming to Whistler, you want to do a stopover in Santa Cruz, like we're actually going to give you bikes for you, and you're like, you're part of the official factory program right now. And I was like, what?
Nice.
That's sick. Yeah. So it was awesome. Santa Cruz, like, you know, supported me as well, like pretty much from the beginning. And that was the start of, without even really like looking for it, that was the start of my pro career.
That's amazing, man. And I think it was a film shoot for the Nomad 3 launch that kind of brought you to a lot of people's attention. There was a classic shot from Gary Perkin of you throwing the horns mid drift. And yeah. I think you weren't even supposed to be part of that shoot initially. Is that right? Wasn't it? I think Chris Johnston was like penciled in for it, but got injured and somehow you got the call.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was interesting. Once again, I think a lot of these things to me happened just being in the right place at the right time, you know, and like making, I think a lot of things that helped me is like, hey, if you put the effort and you put yourself in good environments and the right places, like good things are going to happen. But like if you stay at home, obviously nothing is really like, it's hard. People don't come looking for you. So back then, once again, I paid for all my flights to go to Whistler to raise the EWS the year before because I just wanted to go to Whistler. I was like, hey, this is a great excuse. You know, I'm going to go racing, but I'm going to Whistler. I'm going to spend a couple of weeks there. And while I was there, I met the organizers from Andes Pacifico, the Chilean guys, Matias and Eduardo. And they were like, hey, we're going to do this race, you know, with Santa Cruz the main sponsor. And it's a new concept, you know, it's multiple day racing and it'll be sick. You should come. I was like, okay, I'll go.
Yeah.
And once again, because my mother was a flight attendant, I could get really cheap flights. If they were like direct flights from Spain. And to Chile, there's one. So actually, with my very little budget, I was able to make it to Chile. And I went and took part in Andes Pacifico. And all of the Santa Cruz guys were there, like the Will from marketing and a bunch of the product guys and stuff. And I got to meet everyone else that worked for Santa Cruz. And during that race, unfortunately, Chris Johnston from the Nomads got really, really bad injury. He broke his elbow. And they were like the day after the race, they were starting shooting for that new Nomad. And so then obviously I was like sitting there and they were all like, oh, what are we going to do? Should we fly someone else? Are we going to do, because I have this whole story about, you know, two people in the video riding these bikes and they had everybody set up, everything set up. And I was just kind of there like, just like, hey, you know, like, I could stay a couple extra days if you need someone else and this. And like, eventually they were like, okay, well, we're going to go with Iago. It's like, he's pretty good. No, like, cause like none of them had really seen me riding that much. But I think, Gary Perkin obviously had been shooting the event before. So I think Gary got to see a little bit of me through the race stages and stuff. I think he like put a word for me. I was like, no, he looks good. He can do it. So yeah, they brought me in for that shoot and spent some epic, like I think it was like 4 or 5 days just shooting around Santiago, some really, really dusty conditions on that awesome new bike. And from there is, I think that's when really start peaking for me, you know, like it was that photo that you mentioned, the one hand drift was everywhere. I remember like, kept getting photos sent from friends like, hey, like there's a photo of you printed huge in Whistler Village and there's a photo of you in Santa Cruz and this and that. I was like, whoa, that's insane. That's so cool. And like I said, being at the right time, at the right place at the right time, like helped me massively.
Yeah. And not being shy of putting yourself forward, I guess, like you're willing to maybe be a bit uncomfortable and just be like, yeah, I'll have a go.
Yeah, for sure. You have to be very sure of yourself. Hey, you want to throw your hat into that ring, you know?
It's amazing. What were you doing race wise at that point? Were you like, are you still dabbling in a bit of downhill and a bit of enduro? Like, how did you end up following the enduro path?
Yeah, so it was interesting because in 2013, I did two enduro world series and downhill world cup, and I was like, I need to decide what I'm going to focus on, you know? And like, I was like, okay, I'll do a bit of both and wherever I'm doing best, that's what I'll stick to. And I did basically exactly the same. I think I was like 50th in the downhill World Cup and I was like 60th in one EWS and 49th in another EWS or something like that. So I was like, oh God, what do I do now? So I honestly went to Santa Cruz like, hey, like, you guys, like, I don't really know what to focus on. Like, I don't know if you guys have an interest in me doing some one thing or the other. And they were like, well, honestly, like, we have the syndicate, so we're pretty good on downhill. But enduro, like, would be cool to have you racing enduro. And I was like, okay, sweet. That's it.
Happy days. I guess it fits more with your, like, desire to travel and see new places as well. Like, there's a bit more variety and a bit more reach around the globe, or certainly there was then anyway with enduro.
Yeah, for sure. Like that was the best decision, you know, the early days of enduro was insane. Like, we were going to like 5 or 6 different spots every year, like different continents, you know. It was so good. I have no regrets. I love enduro, and like that was like, it was a huge discovery for me, because obviously coming in from downhill, I wasn't really used to being for so long out there in the mountains, you know. Like, I'd go for like an hour and a half training ride and that was it, and usually it was more like a cross country ride than anything else. And then racing enduro, like, it opened up like a whole new aspect of mountain biking to me, and I started getting into it a lot, you know, just going out there to tracks that as a downhill racer I would have never ridden, because there were, you could not shuttle them, or they were past the hour and a half riding mark. So it was really cool for me to just get to experience that new aspect and like, and all of these new places. And it was so cool, you know. It was the best.
Yeah, man. How has enduro changed then in the sort of, I guess it's knocking on for 10 years that you've been involved with it? Like, we seem to have seen a huge shift in what enduro is, and that's not been a straight line path either. It's kind of almost every year it's sort of changed.
Yeah. It was, it's been really cool being a part of it from the beginning, because, you know, like, enduro has had to figure out what enduro was, really, right? So, like, in the early days, it was always like a 2-day race. We even got a 1 or 2 3-day races and all over the world, and different kinds of like, oh, we need 20-minute stages, and then we went to like, no, we need shorter stages and this and that, and like finding that balance. I think I don't even know if enduro hasn't figured out it himself yet, you know. Like, it's still developing. It's such a young sport. Like, you look at it, like, it looks like it's been here for a while, but it's only been 11 years really of like the high level enduro racing. So it's been really cool seeing it, how it's been changing. And like, I keep speaking with people, and people saying like, oh, enduro is like, it's a very low right now. It's like, enduro has been going through ups and downs like for the last 10 years. Like, I've heard this a couple times already, you know. So I'm hopeful that, you know, it's gonna come back up. You know, we have good times and we have bad times, and I think it's part of the development of this sport, and how it's gonna how it's gonna evolve into whatever it has to be.
Yeah.
It needs to go through this aspect, I guess. When enduro, like right now, everybody thinks that enduro is not in a great spot. But the good thing about that is that everybody is thinking about how to make it better. You know, I think like I keep seeing it everywhere, from riders, from team managers, brands, filmers, photographers, everybody's like really like, you know, working hard into trying to figure out, hey, okay, what do we need? What can we do to make it better? You know, instead of like when the sport is like going really well, like everybody's just like sitting on the back seat and just being like, okay, let's go, where are we going? I'm coming, you know. But now is I think it's exciting, and I think good things are gonna come from this, you know. Like, obviously you see a lot of people putting effort and thinking on ways of improving all of the aspects, really, not even only like the racing wise.
Nice, that's cool, man. It's really interesting to hear that positive perspective on it, because there is a lot of kind of negative feelings, and I completely understand that. Like, looking from the outside last year, it looked a little bit unloved, and it definitely sort of lacked exposure, I guess, which means brands struggle to justify return on investment and bringing money in. Like, if it was yours, what would you do with it? Like, what do you think would help improve the sport, you know, both from a racing perspective, but also from a sort of a fan perspective, a coverage and accessibility perspective?
It's really hard to tell. I think at the beginning it was like really exciting to be like, okay, so we're part of the World Cup circus now, and we're gonna be at the same places as all these people are. But, you know, there's only so much attention from the public, right? Like, there's 10,000 eyes, and if there's 3 places to look at, not everybody's going to look at the same place, you know? And I think we need a little bit more independence from the other sports. I think, unfortunately, being surrounded by, you know, downhill or cross country, it takes a lot of the attention. And like, and we could all, I remember all, like back in the days, there were some races that the EWS was at the same time as the downhill races. And you can notice a lot how much of that attention, even though you were in different corners of the world, was going somewhere else instead of enduro. But the weekends that only an enduro World Series was happening, like all the eyes were on there, like even people that maybe weren't so interested, but like it was the only thing to look at. So I think that would definitely help us a little bit more. Yeah. I know for organizers, maybe it's easier to have all of this, all downhill and enduro together, but honestly, I think it's probably a nightmare because, you know, like downhill, it's already like very, very challenging. And if you throw in enduro, which is like with resources, like it might even be more, you know, like there's more tracks to tape, to take care of, to marshal, to coordinate schedules, to from ambulances, everything, you know, like it's a wider operation. So I think hopefully in the future, we're going to have a little bit more separation because I think, you know, like having downhill and cross country is probably really good because they're kind of different spectators and it's not really, I guess cross country practice is not super, I don't know how many people go to watch cross country practice. So like, it's okay that downhill is happening at the same time as cross country practice and things like that, because it's not gonna overlap, you know, and people are going to have to choose really. But whenever you're having enduro and downhill at the same time, it's probably difficult for the fans to choose where to go. So that would be one of the first things I'll kind of try and do, just get out away from downhill and see where that gets us.
I think that's totally right. Like, it was a shame to see, like in Leergang, it felt massively overshadowed by the cross country and the downhill. Like it felt like it was like third in the pecking order, and it deserves more than that. And I think that happened on the websites, right? There's only a certain amount of web traffic. There's only a certain amount of photographers, videographers, and the hierarchy seems to be that they'll focus on cross country and downhill ahead of that because there's a live broadcast and all that. So yeah, I think separating it would be good. Has it been hard then to see like some of your fellow athletes and good friends without teams for this year? Because it does feel like it's been a pretty tough year, and this isn't just because of the challenges for the enduro side of racing. I think it's just a reflection on the bike industry in general, but it's definitely been tough for some people, hey?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody could relate to this. I imagine everybody has seen their jobs taken away from them or having to find a new job, and it is so stressful. For us, really, like, we obviously have a passion and this is what we want to do and we're really happy doing it. But it's every year, every 2 years, you have to find or resign your job, you know, like you need to fight for your job every year, every 2 years. And it's so stressful. And I've been really lucky, really, because I spent 10 years riding for the same brand. So it was always like pretty straightforward, you know. But a year ago when Santa Cruz decided to close their enduro team, I've definitely spent a couple of months struggling to sleep. You know, you're like, every night you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, is this over? Do I need to start looking for jobs? You know, like I haven't worked, even though I've studied and I have a university degree and stuff, like I haven't used any of those resources for so long. Like, I don't know where to start. And it's super stressful. And I think, I know it's been really, really hard for a lot of these people. It's cool seeing how some people have, like, you know, changed their approach and like trying to like repackage themselves to become something different and still be able to do what they like. But I think it's more a problem of the industry and how the money that is available than those riders are not valuable. For sure. And that's the wrong way of looking at it. I think in a year or two, hopefully this is the industry is getting better. All those people will, or even more people will be able to get back to their job and where they were before. So, I just hope that, everybody's able to keep doing what they're doing and, just maybe like we'll have a year or two of struggles, but then it all's going to get better.
Let's hope so, man. So yeah, how did the Cannondale thing come about for you? And are you a team manager role on that as well as a rider? How's that all work?
Yeah, so I was super lucky. So I was on 2022. I was traveling doing all the Enduro World Series with my with Ella, with my partner Ella, and when we're in America, I got to stay with her and a bunch of the Cannondale people, just to save some cost, and I get to meet them and spend some days with them, and by the end of the trip, Jonathan from Cannondale came to me. It's like, hey, I've been looking at what you do, how you've been helping Ella and other people, and I think you'd be a great team manager. We're looking for a team manager and a rider, and maybe you might be interested in this. And I was like, yes,
definitely.
I'll be really interested. You know, it was awesome being able to, you know, we're traveling and training together, Ella and I, the whole time, but you know, like to actually officially be able to do it and like join resources and all the efforts into doing everything in a more efficient way. It was really, really cool. And Cannondale has been always an amazing brand. And, you know, my first proper mountain bike, I had half of a Cannondale from that tandem. So like, I've known Cannondale, I've been a fan, and it was really exciting for me, the opportunity. And luckily, Cannondale was able to make it happen. You know, we got a deal, and, I'm now the team manager and one of their riders for the Enduro team. And it's really cool to see how like a lot of brands, you know, are choosing to cut on some brands. It's not cool that they're choosing to cut. Sorry, it's cool how Cannondale has decided not to cut on Enduro racing and like trying to like, you know, they're obviously like trying to save as much as they can, but they're still supporting the sport and they believe in the sport. And it's been really, really rewarding working with them.
Yeah, and you're back working with Will Ockleton, I guess, right? Because Will was marketing at Santa Cruz when you were there and is now, I think, looking after Cannondale.
Yeah, so it was really cool. Will started working for Cannondale at the end of last summer. And yeah, it was like a reunion. yeah, we were having dinner with him and Radboy was there too. And we were like, oh, look, we're back together here. Like, it's really cool. I think Will obviously was a huge part of my career. He was the one that chose to support me from the beginning as a professional racer. And, I have a lot of faith in what he does. And I think it's going to, together with him and Cannondale, is going to be able to even get bigger and better.
Nice. Yeah, it was cool to see Josh back at a little bit of e-enduro racing as well at the back end of last year. I think it was in Chatel.
Yeah. No, he's it's awesome to have him around. He's always like with such high energy and so stoked about riding bikes, and he loved it. He was having such a good time riding in Chatel. He chose a great race because there were really, really good tracks, and I think he got him really, really keen on some more racing. So hopefully we'll see him in a couple more this year.
That would be ace. Yeah, it's infectious watching that guy ride a bike and giggle his way down the track. So hopefully we get to see a bit more of it. Let's talk a bit about your 2023 season, man, because it took a bit of a turn in Pietrelugura. Tell us a little bit about that experience, because I guess it came completely out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to me, honestly. I was racing. I was in race day in Pietrelugura, and I had done the first stage, and I was feeling really good, actually, probably too good. I got to the bottom feeling like, oh, that wasn't that hard, you know, like this wasn't as physical as I thought it was going to be. And I looked around and everybody was like, you know, on their handlebars, like breathing super hard. Like, what are you talking about? I was like, oh shit, maybe I didn't try hard enough. You know, I struggle. I am always like a build up for the day. It's hard for me to attack from the get go. So I was going pedaling up, and I was like, oh my God, the second stage, I cannot do this again. I need to go full on, you know, I have to try hard. And so I started on that second stage, and I was like really, really like pushing this time. And I was feeling it. I was like, you know, I'm usually a very, very conservative rider. Like, I just don't really take many risks. Uh-huh. I like sticking to my lines and like being safe and minimizing risk and stuff. But when I start getting a little bit loose and I get a little sketchy situation, getting away with it, it's like, okay, this has got to be faster because I'm actually risking a little bit, you know? So I was having a little couple of those moments that I was like, okay, yes, this is good. Keep going, keep going. And there was a tiny climb in the middle of the stage. And when I got to the top of that climb, suddenly my ears started buzzing. Really weird. You know how like you're in an airplane and like kind of you want your ears to pop. Well, that it was like that, but like times 10. And I was trying to like, I was trying to make them pop while I was riding down and trying like, okay, keep going. Cause you're in a good run. You need to keep going. You cannot let this distract you. And, eventually, like after, I don't know, like 20, 30 seconds, they suddenly popped. And I was like, oh, perfect. Okay. Now I can keep going. And immediately after that, I started getting that really, really bad headache. Like this pressure was like in my head and I could feel like my heartbeat through that headache. So like it was coming like on and off constantly. And then it went back down to my neck to the point that it was so painful. I couldn't even move my neck, but I was like, oh, this is so weird. I must have like pinched the nerve or something, you know, like my neck is, I was like, this is so weird. I haven't crashed. I haven't done anything wrong. Like, so I was like, oh, I cannot wait. Like, I need to get to the bottom because I'm on a good run. So I finished riding, like, the end of the stage had, like, a super, like, steep, tight switchbacks. And I was just, like, with that, like, a locked neck, just, like, making it down, like, little by little, trying not to stop. I couldn't look around, so I could only look forward. And I got to the bottom. I was like, okay, I'm going to get to the bottom. I'm going to sit down for a minute, I'm going to relax, and then I'm sure like it's going to get better and can keep going to stage three. But unfortunately, I got to the bottom, I lay down, and I couldn't move from there. Like, the pain was so unbearable, I couldn't even open my eyes. And everybody started, like, there was Tom from the Enduro World Cup, the social media guy was there, and he started asking me, he's like, hey, you okay? I was like, yeah, I think so. And he was like, did you crash? I was like, no. And he was like, oh. Like, everybody was really confused. Like, you didn't crash, but were you in the ground, on the ground like that? And I was like, no, I just need to rest for a little bit and then I'll keep going. And eventually, like, I couldn't see anything, but I could hear all the riders coming by, you know, I knew when the woman had come by, and then the other elite men came down, and I was like, oh, this, I've been here for a while, I'm not gonna make it to the next stage. And eventually Tom made the decision, and he called the medics, and they came up, and they were also really confused. They were like, oh, he's in his head. I was like, no, I didn't crash. And so they didn't really understand. But then the emergency doctor came, and they got me in a stroller, they got me into the 4x4 ambulance. And like in a couple of minutes, he was like, I heard her say, like, I think he's got a brain aneurysm. We need to get him to the hospital immediately.
Whoa.
And I had no idea what that meant, to be honest. No, I was like, oh, brain thing. That's not probably very good. And I was in a lot of pain, like, honestly, like the worst headache you could ever imagine. And I got to the hospital, and once again, I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. I think turns out Pietra Ligure has a hospital with one of the best neuroscience, neurology surgery teams in Italy.
Wow!
So I got straight up taken to the best place I could have gone, and immediately they start running tests on me, and that same afternoon they were doing surgery to try and fix my aneurysm.
So an aneurysm is where is it like a blood vessel or something that kind of expands in your brain? What actually is it?
Yeah, so how they explain it to me is like our vessels are made of multiple layers, right? And they are like they stretch to adapt to the different like pressures and blood flows that you need. Sometimes it's really hard to tell why it is. They say most cases it's a genetic thing, like you're just born with it. Some of those layers, either they're not there or they're weaker. Uh-huh. So at some point, the blood, instead of going through your vessel, it starts pushing against the wall of the vessel and it creates a little balloon, uh-huh. And starts collecting there. And obviously there's no room for that. all that blood is not supposed to be there to start. If it's in your brain, it starts building up the pressure. And the problem is that that could then explode, and then you end up with a brain hemorrhage. Uh-huh. So it's a simple thing, but deadly. They told me 25% of people don't make it through the first 24 hours of that.
When did they tell you that?
After everything. Like, I had no idea really what was going on with me until like 10 days after. I was in so much pain the whole time. Wow. Like, I could barely talk and everything, that I just, yeah, I was a bit oblivious, which I think it was good.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's sometimes if it's good or not to know that you kind of fighting for your life. But to me, it was just like, yeah, it was like every time I've been injured, you're like, okay, well, you get surgery and then the next day you're better. Right. Yeah. Well, I got surgery and I wasn't feeling any better. And the next morning they came and they're like, oh, you're going to surgery again. And I had no idea why. And it turns out the first surgery wasn't successful, and my aneurysm actually popped. So I did get an hemorrhage. So then they had to come up with a different surgery where they actually had to like open up my head and close that little balloon thing from the outside. So yeah, it was pretty gnarly. Unfortunately, I was like, okay, well, second surgery, like, I'm going to be good now. And I was still like for another 5 or 6 days, which is the worst headache. Like, I couldn't even sit up. Yeah. Because the pressure, you know, like there was, even though they had like clean up most of the blood that had been around my brain and stuff, there was still like things that were not supposed to be in your head. So even just sitting up was like, the gravity just was making my headache so bad. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't even like, I could barely eat because I was like standing, like laying on the bed. And it was really difficult for sure. Like, I was in the intensive care for, I think it was like 10 or 12 days. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time to start feeling better. But then, hopefully luckily the team there was amazing. You know, like they had the doctor that did the surgery was amazing. Apparently is a really well-respected Dr. Caghetti from Italy. And the whole, like all the nurses and all the doctors, like, were amazing. They were stopping by every day and checking on me. And I definitely got, I think, the best care I could have had. And eventually things started sorting out, and I was able to finally like sit up and start eating more. And I think from there, like, the recovery sped up a lot. And I was connected to like 3 different machines that were pumping different medicines to me, because it was, you know, like you're very delicate, because obviously you have like kind of like an open vessel in your body. Yeah. And like you could bleed out really easily. But then once I got better and they could unplug me from all of those different medicines and stuff, I started to be able to stand up. You know, I could eat, I could get out of bed, go on little walks. And from there, like, then I was like in a way better place. I started just doing laps on the corridor of the hospital, and the nurses and the doctors will come to me like, hey, you're gonna wear off our floors, you know, you're walking so much. And I was like, I need to move, you know, I've been on a bed for 15 days, I need to move. And it was very difficult, but luckily I had a lot of support, you know, from all my family, friends, and even like people I had never met before. You know, they were sending me all these really nice messages that whenever I was reading them, like I could feel the love, and it's so nice, you know, like it definitely helps you with your how you look at things, how you look at life. And you know, if you stay in a positive mindset, it like recovery is always going to go so much better. And yeah, forever grateful to all those people that, you know, took some time and send messages or called. And yeah,
that's cool, man. It's good you had that support. What were they telling you that like 10, 11 days in intensive care? Did you know whether you'd make a full recovery? Did you know if you'd be able to ride again? Like, how much information did you have to like help you process and deal with that time?
Yeah, it was, like I said, I could, the first couple of days, like, they're kind of a blur. Like, I was in so much pain that all I could do is, like, close my eyes and, like, just hope to get to sleep, you know? So I didn't really know much. I honestly thought it wasn't that bad. And it was only until I got out of hospital that Ella told me that I was fighting for my life, you know? Okay. Which it was pretty gnarly when I heard that. But yeah, like when I actually got to start speaking with like the doctors a little bit more, the doctor that did the surgery was always like so confident. She was like, yeah, no, you're going to be fine. She was like, yeah, you're going to write. Of course you're going to, she's like, not now. Like every time, like, you're going to have to take a couple months, Jill, you know, but like, but you're going to be okay. I was like, really? Like, to me, it was like really hard to believe because, you know, you were just like poking around my brain. Like, how is that? How am I going to get a full recovery? But they were like always like really confident that I was going to be okay. And that was really good. Like, obviously, once again, like it helps you. I think a lot of the times the doctors are really conservative with what they tell you, right? Like, you always like, usually they tell you worse things that you want to hear. They're like, oh no, you're not going to be able to walk properly again, and this and that, you know, like every time, usually you like defy what they're saying and you actually recover and you're okay. And this time the doctors were really, really confident. They're like, well, you know, you're going
to
be fine.
That's amazing. Did you find it hard to be away from riding? Like, how long were you completely off of a bike for?
So I spent 20 days in hospital. And then another month and a half without riding, I think. And, you know, to be honest, at first, like, I was in such bad shape. Like, it wasn't even like, I was like, I was more thinking, am I going to be able to ride again more than I want to ride again?
Yeah.
It was more the question if, like, you know, I was really, that was the thing that was haunting me the most. I was like, okay, they're saying I'm going to be okay, but like, okay as a normal person or okay as a professional rider, you know, like, am I going to be able to come back to where I was like a month ago? Yeah. Am I going to be able to ride my bike fast and process things fast and react fast and all these things that you need to, you know, to be an elite athlete? And that was the question I was constantly like on my mind. And I don't know, like, I've obviously gone through those things, you know, when you break a bone and you're away for a while and you're thinking about it. And to me, the thing, it was like, I can totally visualize what I need to do. You know, if I was seeing a video or I was imagining myself in a situation, like, I can perfectly visualize what I have to do, you know, to rail a corner, to jump, to do this, to do a whip, to like approach a rock garden, whatever. Like, I can visualize, I can see myself doing it. So I was like, I must be able to do it. I don't know. That was my thought process. And it was tricky, you know. It was really hard, even though the doctor said I was gonna make a full recovery. They didn't really help me much with how that recovery is gonna look like. I kept asking, like, okay, so when can I ride? And they're like, not yet. And I was like, no, but like, give me a time, like in a month, 2 months. They're like, maybe one, maybe 2 months. I was like, oh. And then like, I was like, and when I can ride, how hard can I ride? You know, can I start doing training? Can I start doing intervals? What can I do? And they're like, oh. I remember I went to a neurosurgeon in Spain, and I was asking him this question. He's like, I don't know. I'm not like a coach, you know, like, you don't ask me what training to do. And it's like, okay, but I need to get back, you know? And so it was a little bit of, I had to figure out by myself, you know? And it was a slow process. I obviously, like, the number one thing that everybody was telling me is, like, you need to take it easy, you know? You need to give yourself a lot of time. Your body needs to heal. And even though everybody was sure that I was, like, the surgery was done, and it's a really safe surgery. Like, once the second one that I got done, they've put actually kind of like a clip on the blood vessel. Mm-hmm. And that's there. Like, it's a very physical thing that is not going to fail. Okay. So they're like, so there's not really risk of, you know, having an hemorrhage again, but like, obviously your body needs a lot of time to heal, to reabsorb whatever was in your brain, like from the previous MRH and all this stuff. So I just, come up with a very, very slow, progressive plan to get back into writing. And I obviously there were some setbacks when I got out of hospital. I flew the next day to Spain back home, and I was like, oh yes, I'm free, you know, like I can walk, I can do this. So I put my headphones on, and I was like, I'm gonna go for a walk. And I went for like, I don't know, it was like 50 minutes or 1 hour walk. I was feeling great, you know. I was out there and walking through the woods, and I got back home and I was like, oh, I'm tired. And the next day I woke up and I was so sore. Like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I'm sore from walking. How is this even possible? And obviously, like, my body was like, is not as good as recovering back then, because it has been laying flat for a month. So it took me 2 days to recover from my one hour walk. And I was like, okay, I need to take it really slow. I need to take it really, really slow. So I started building this training program where, like, I would start with 20 minutes walking, and the next day I was okay, I will do another extra five. I would do 25 minutes, and then I'd do that for 2 days, and then I go another 5 minutes, and like really progressive, really tracking my blood pressure, tracking my heart rate, how I was feeling, and definitely resting a lot. So whenever I was home, I was like laying down or sat down. And after a month, I was like, okay, I think I should be okay to start pedaling a little bit. So I jumped on the turbo trainer, and I started again from scratch, like same idea, like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, like building little by little, until I got another appointment with a doctor, and I asked him, I was like, hey, like, what do you think? And he's like, okay, you can start riding, but you can't ride alone, because there's like, it was in August and it was really, really hot. It's like, problem now is like, if you get really, really hot, like you might pass out or something. So it's important that you're always with someone. So luckily Ella was willing to be my little training buddy, and more like my guardian. And we started going on once again, starting again from half an hour road ride, really chill, like on the easiest gear I had the whole time, and building from there. And eventually we decided to get in our camper van and go to the Pyrenees, trying to escape a little bit of the heat, and that way Ella could train a little bit better, you know, on some proper enduro trails. And we drove past this valley in Spain, the Aran Valley, where some friends had just built like a little jump park. And we drove past it once, and you could literally see it from the road. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. Like, I want to try that. But then I was like, no, I need to take it easy. The doctor said, I need to take it easy. So we went somewhere else. And then like a week or 10 days later, we passed again through there again. And we went riding. I was on my gravel bike going with Ella up the climbs, and then she was riding down the single track, and I was coming back down the dirt roads. And the next day I spoke with Ella. I was like, hey, you know, I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to get on my mountain bike. And I think I need to go see how I am on the mountain bike, like how are my skills. So I've come up with this idea. I was kind of trying to convince myself. I was like, there's no better place than the jump park, because like we're right next to the car. So if anything happens, you know, like I can get back into the car. It's really short, so like I can just walk up, and it'll be a good way of getting into mountain biking, the next step. So we went there, and like, yeah, I was like having to really like control myself. Like, okay, take it really easy. Walk as slowly as you can up the hill so you don't get your heart rate up. And then if you're just jumping really chill, then your heart rate's not going to go up either. So like, it's going to be really good. And, that was so good. Cause I had my first go on the jumps, and I just felt like home, you know. I was like, I couldn't believe it. It had been like over two months without riding a mountain bike. And it's funny because you're like, I've been injured, but haven't really, like, you know, my muscles were good, my bones were good, my brain was good, like nothing was really hurt. It was just, I just had an Emirates, but like my body was working perfectly. So it was almost an easier return to mountain biking than when you've broken an elbow or you've broken a leg or something. And it was so good. Like that day I was like, okay, I can do it again. You know, like I'm going to be able to ride the bike. Maybe, I don't know if like 100%, but definitely a 90%. So from there, it was all good times. You know, every day I had to be honest, I had to take like another week not riding mountain bikes because the next day I decided to do a little trail and I didn't feel fast enough with my abilities. And it was really hard for me to like read the track and go fast. I was feeling really slow. Ella was really enjoying it though, because she was riding in front of me and I was struggling to keep up with her. She's like, "Ha, now you know how it feels." And it was cool. So I took another week of just road riding. And then when I came back, it was just like rediscovering riding, you know, like it was, I was likely, we were in the Pyrenees, then we went to Morsin for the World Cups. And, I got to ride with our mechanic, Carlos. And, you know, like imagine it felt to me like I hadn't ridden for a year. And suddenly you're in a bike park doing laps with your friends. It was just like, this is the best thing ever. I can't believe it. And yeah, I decided, even though I could have like actually physically take part of a race, you know, I could have raced in Châtel. I didn't think it was like the best option because obviously when you're racing against the best in the world, if you're not 100%, it's not really a point. So I decided to, instead of like, you know, get back into shape, enjoy. I felt like I had gone through enough struggles through that summer that I wanted to just enjoy life, enjoy riding. And it was super refreshing. You know, I had so much fun. It was like the month of September was insane for me, riding a lot, riding with friends and like watching. It was the first time that I was on an EWS or World Cup watching from the outside. So it was really cool. It was refreshing to witness that from a different perspective.
Yeah. And you came, I think you, did you ride Shakedown or ride some of Shakedown? I'm sure I saw a Sven shot of you like.
Yeah. Yeah. So I rode practice in Ludenville and Châtel. Yeah. I rode with Ella and, it was really cool because as well, like Ella had, let alone the having to deal with what was happening to me. She had a concussion and she hadn't really ridden much at the start of the summer. But she put a lot of work in through that break and being able to ride with her in practice. Usually she's more following me and we're working on lines and stuff, but like I had never actually watched her ride on a race scenario, like on practice and stuff. And I was following her. I was like, oh my God, it's like, almost like, you're better than what I picture you are when you're riding behind me, you know? I was like mind blown. She was riding really, really well. So it was super cool to just ride behind her in a bunch of stages and just being there, helping her with lines. It definitely made me feel valuable even though I wasn't racing. So it was really cool to be able to do that.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, and awesome to feel that fresh excitement for riding again after a bit of an enforced break is super cool. And you got back to racing literally just this weekend gone, I think. And it was, you decided to go all in and have a little downhill race, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah, once again, I thought it's better to race 1 3-minute stage to begin than to do a whole day of riding. And, you know, Ella wanted to do some downhill racing this year and I was keen too. So we have a couple of races early season here in Spain for downhill and we decided to go down to Malaga, you know, good weather and good tracks. And we went to race the first round of the Spanish Open and it was really cool, but it was one of the gnarliest tracks I've ever seen. Like looking back, I was like, oh, I don't know if it was such a good idea because I was scared. You know, we did track walk and they were all rocks. There was just rocks everywhere. Like I've never seen such a rough track in my life. And I was like, okay, I definitely don't want to get injured on my first race. I want to go, you know, I want to work, build up. So took a very safe approach and my goal was finding the smoothest lines with the least amount of rocks and didn't want to risk it much, but it was so much fun, man. Like, you know, the process of the racing downhill and like figuring out a track and seeing what works and what doesn't work, and seeing how when you figure out how to ride a section, it like gives you more speed for the next section. So then you need to look at this section differently and all of this. Like, it's this whole process is like really, really cool. And I hadn't done it for so long. Like, honestly, like my last race, I think it was my last proper downhill race, it was at Cranworth Leger on the year before they did the World Cup there. That would have been like 7 or 8 years ago. So it was a really long time. So it was really cool. I actually enjoyed it a lot. So we're doing another race next weekend.
Nice.
Just to you know, build up, and hopefully, luckily this track has way less rocks, so should be a little bit less stressful. But yeah, it's you know, just racing mountain bikes down the hill, is nothing beats it.
Pretty cool, man. And are you like physically like all good? You can push hard, you can get your heart rate up, like is everything like back to normal from that perspective?
Yeah. So I've been already like over a month doing like, you know, max efforts on the bike and training intervals and all these things. That was one of my biggest concerns. So I actually went to two doctors to check, because I went to the first doctor and the guy was like, oh, no, you're going to be fine. Like, nothing's wrong. I was like, are you sure? And he was like, do you know Lance Armstrong or Alberto Contador? Have you heard of those? I was like, yeah. It's like, well, they had very similar surgeries to you, and look at them, they were back to normal. I was like, okay, that's good to know. You know, like it's not just any other guy. You know, they're like really high intensity athletes that are going back to normal and doing what they want. So, definitely, my coach was really, really worried to give me those training plans with those maximum efforts. But you know, we've been once again progressively building up. I got a bunch of test downs, you know, VO2 max tests and things like that to make sure that everything was working well. And yeah, it's all good. So just need to get back in shape.
Fair play, man. That is amazing to hear. I'm stoked that you're back to full fitness, and it's going to be exciting to see you back at the races, providing some entertainment for us all. And there's always some incredible shots of you riding and styling it up through the tracks.
Thank you.
We should talk a bit about Do You Even Drift Bro or Diad Bro, a business that you founded. I think the name in the first place came off the back of that Gary Perkins shoot right out in Chile.
Yeah. So, back then, Gary, I don't really understand where it comes from, but like Gary was into doing hashtags about inspired by the Do You Even Lift Bro hashtag. That was the trendy thing back then. And when we did that photo, that same day, Gary was so stuck on the photo. He downloaded it, he edited it, and like he put a hashtag Do You Even Drift Bro on the photo and sent it to all of the Santa Cruz people. Like, look what we're doing down south. And it kind of became kind of like my signature thing, you know. Everybody was like, oh, Do You Even Drift Bro, you know, like do a drift photo and this and that. Forward a couple of years later, I had a friend that was helping me with some of my, like, you know, printing my jerseys and stuff like that. And he was like, hey, you know, like I bought this heat press to make t-shirts, and I was thinking we should start a clothing brand. Do you have any ideas? I was like, oh, you know, like I have this Do You Even Drift Bro thing that maybe could be turned into a company, you know, into a brand. And he liked the idea, and we made like 20 t-shirts, and most of them were bought by my friends. and then we were like, okay, well, we need to figure out ways of like promote our brand a little bit more. And back then he was just making like clear wraps for bikes, mm-hmm. just like for our bikes, for his bikes and my bikes and stuff. And I was like, oh, you know what? I was thinking it could be cool if we printed something on those things. Can we do that? And it was like, yeah, of course. I was like, why are we not doing it? He was like, I don't know. So I was like, oh, let's do like, I don't know, like some camo stuff and print it. And then I can give it out to friends, and then maybe we can use it as promotion for our t-shirt company. And we did that. I took them to some races and I gave it to people, and people really liked it. And a lot of other pro riders like put them on their bikes and stuff. And back then we were only doing like top tubes. And eventually we were like well, actually, this is going better than the t-shirt thing. Maybe we should just start to doing frame protectors. And that's kind of how we started the company. And it's been really, really, really cool because we were able to build it progressively, little by little, every year, doing more things and developing the product a little bit more and adding more designs. And right now it's like an actual company. You know, we have employees, and we're creating something that to me is super rewarding. You know, I travel around the world and I see something that I've come up with on random people's bikes, I'm really proud of that. You know, like, it's really, really cool to get to see that someone likes something enough that they're gonna buy it and they're actually gonna put it on their bike, and you know, and they're gonna rock it. And it's really cool. It's been really exciting.
That is nice. What's your involvement with it these days? Like, how much time you spend on it? What sort of stuff are you doing?
So luckily we have our employee Vicente, which he runs the day to day, and he's, you know, like ordering product and shipping out things and the small things. But I've always been more in charge of like, how was my self-appointed title? It was creative director of marketing or something. Okay. Like that. So I've always been the one like choosing the designs and kind of like working with the graphic designers and the artist on how the product was going to look like, and obviously testing it, always putting it on my bike, changing things. And then, marketing, just hopefully, luckily I have a lot of good friends that are professional riders, and they've been willing to help me spread the word on the company. And, I have a lot of contacts that has definitely helped me, you know, spread the word, and I've been putting out marketing plans and things like that. So, lately I've been a little bit more involved on the day to day, with my business partner Mariano and Vicente. And you know, it's a difficult time in the industry right now, like everybody knows, and we're noticing it. But luckily, we're a small enough company that we can adapt to the times, and we're putting together plans to try and, like, you know, get back to a good level of business and making more stuff that people are stoked about.
Awesome. And I guess it's like, compared to buying a bike, for example, it's a much sort of cheaper thing, so maybe not quite as impacted by some of the like cost of living crisis and all that side of things, and maybe not as badly hit as some brands in the industry.
Yeah, for sure. Like, we're able to adapt because we never have to make massive orders. You know, we're able to kind of like produce on demand, and our stock problem is not as bad. It's not as bad as having 1,000 $12,000 bikes in stock than 1,000 $40 frame protectors in stock. So we're able to adapt, but I think it's tricky because you would think like, okay, it's probably it's not so expensive, maybe people are still gonna buy it. But I think a lot of people actually start cutting on the small things earlier, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, they're like, hey, what is not absolutely necessary that we can avoid spending money on that? So we definitely felt it. I think obviously the start of the year is the hardest part for mountain bike companies, because when the weather is super grim, I don't think a lot of people actually look at riding their bike or even spending money on the bike. But I'm feeling positive. I think in the next couple months, you know, things are gonna start getting a little bit better and reactivate, and hopefully for the whole industry, it's gonna start getting progressively better.
I hope so, man. I hope so. Yeah, yeah, for everybody, it's gonna be easier if the sun comes out and people are out on their bikes again and starting to spend a bit of money in the industry. It'd be cool. So, what's next for you, man? Like, you've been through this huge, I don't know whether you call it an injury or what, but like a big moment in your life that has given you time to think and, you know, force you to step away from what you love for a bit. Like, I get the impression that the stoke for mountain bikes is still there, the excitement for racing is still there, but like, yeah, where do you see things going? What are you hoping to achieve this year or in the next few years?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a lot of I think it's kind of like a cliche for anyone that goes through like a life-changing moment in their lives, but like, you learn to appreciate life so much more. And it's made me realize how much I love riding my bike. And it's made me realize that I really want to do it, because you don't have to do anything wrong. And that could change like so fast. Like, you never know. You never know what's coming. So I'm definitely looking at life in a different way and just trying to always like enjoy what I'm doing and don't really get too frustrated or too bothered by the small bumps on the road, because they're just small bumps on the road, you know. Like, you could be in the hospital bed right now, but you're not. So like, this little problem that you think is a huge problem, like, don't let it bother you too much, you know. Try and like work on fixing it, but don't let it like take sleep off from you. So it's changed my life in that way, that yeah, I just want to keep riding my bike. I want to keep being involved in the sport, and the plan is to race this year, and I'm definitely putting all the work that I can, and I'm trying to come back to where I was, and I think we'll see what happens. I'm feeling good, so I think it's going to be a good year. But yeah, all I know is I want to keep riding my bike every day.
That's awesome, man. Do you feel like you're happier as a result of that, like, reflection that moment's given you?
For sure. I think looking back, like, you know, the past couple of months since the injury have been some of my best months in life, you know. Like, I've actually genuinely enjoyed what I've been doing so much, you know, that it's really cool, you know, because I'm like, okay, well, let's carry that on, you know. Like, always just be happy with what you're doing and enjoy every moment. And and obviously, like, I'm not saying everything has been like, you know, great, and like, I haven't had any problems or any struggles, but like, definitely the good times have been so much better that I think if I can continue living like that, it's definitely something that everybody, or like, just trying to like enjoy the good times even more.
Good to hear.
Just take them in and ride your bikes and share your time with friends and family, and stop to look at the mountains, you know, like, even those little things. Just appreciate them.
Yeah.
Because literally, you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, and you might not be able to be out there again.
Yeah. Wise words, mate. Wise words. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time. We've got our final four questions that we've asked most people over the years. So we're going to hit those up. And the first one of those is, if our listeners had £150, which is about 175 euros, to improve their performance on a bike, and they can't go and spend it on Diet Bro kits, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
So I always listen to this question. I don't know, when I listen to your podcast, what would I say? It's tricky, you know. I think the one thing that has changed a lot my riding, it's actually not a part or a component on my bike. It's been strong.
Okay.
So I think if you could spend that money into a subscription to a training program or a gym membership, like, honestly, it changes your riding so much. The stronger you are, the better you're riding, the longer you can ride for, the, you know, like, you can control your bike, I think. And we don't really, I guess it's changing, but when I started racing, like, it wasn't, the gym wasn't really like, oh, you're a biker, you train, you go and ride your bike, you know, and you do more runs, so you'll get strong, but you'll never be able to get to the next level of strength if you're not actually working out in a gym. Yeah. And in a gym, or like, even at home, like, you know, everything's going to help you. If you've never been to a gym, you start doing some push-ups and you start doing some anything, exercises to get stronger muscles and stuff, like, is gonna affect your riding so much more.
That is a great answer, man. I'm 100% with you on that. I've massively noticed the changes in my riding, my ability to like save moments that would have had me in the undergrowth before, my ability to ride longer and harder and enjoy it more. So yeah, fair play. Like that one. Yeah. All right, next one. And maybe we've sort of covered this a little bit, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Well, I think, kind of related to this question, I would tell myself to train more.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I look back and like my my first years of you know, like junior, like my junior racing days, like where I was like training, you know, I had a training program, I was going out and like doing intervals and stuff. I look back at it now, it's like, that was nothing. It's like, you could have done so much more. And like imagine if you were training as hard as you're training now, like 15 years ago, you would have done so much better, and like your races and like your bike riding and everything. So I think, yeah, I would definitely tell myself to train more and train harder.
Fair play. I like it. All right, third one. If you could have a coaching session from anybody, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
That's really tricky, because so many people I look up to.
You can have a couple if it helps.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's just always, I think I've heard this answer a lot of times, but Sam Hill is there, eh? Sam Hill is just unquestionable. He is the man. And growing up in the era that I grew up, where Sam was the absolute man,
yeah.
Not that he's not right now, which he is, but just watching him ride corners like he does, it's a dream for sure. Like if he wants to share some of that knowledge with me, you know, Sam, you know what, you reach me, we can go for a fun riding session.
Yeah, absolute legend for sure. It'd be interesting to see where he ends up, what he ends up doing. Like, he hasn't made a statement yet as to what the future holds for him, but obviously with no more Nuke Proof racing team, yeah, it'd be interesting to see where he goes. It'd be a shame if we don't see him like on a bike or at a racetrack or on video segments or whatever. But yeah, always a great rider to watch, man, for sure. All right.
I hope we get to see him on a race soon.
I hope so. Fingers crossed. All right, last one, man. What do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
I guess just being consistent with writing. I think just it doesn't even have to be training, just riding your bike. If you can every day, like, it definitely helps you stay healthier. You know, I sleep better if I don't ride my bike and I don't do anything. I cannot sleep. And then I'm like tired the next day and I'm grumpy or whatever. So like, I think it's just all a vicious cycle. So if you staying active, doing something every day is important. It's really important to me, and I think it for everybody. Like, just it's gonna help your health and your happiness massively.
Yeah, definitely, mate. Definitely. Nice one, man. Well, it's been a real pleasure finally getting the chance to sit down and have a good old chat. I've really enjoyed it. I'm stoked to hear that you're fully recovered and that, you know, even through those dark days, it's given you some perspective that's helped you have a happier and more fulfilled time, which is ace. If people want to follow you throughout the season, like, where's the best place for them to be looking?
It's Iago Garay on all social media, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, whatever. Iago, IAGO. And love people to follow me there and send me a message if you feel like it's always cool to connect with people.
Nice. And what about Dyad, bro? Where are we looking to find that stuff?
Yeah, so you can go online on dyadbro.com, mm-hmm. and we ship worldwide, and you can see all the cool things that we make. And you can same dyadbro on Instagram. And please check it out, because we make cool stuff.
Nice one, man.
You're going to like it.
You do. Yeah, awesome. I'll stick links to all of that stuff in the show notes. But yeah, been a real pleasure chatting, man. And look forward to seeing you back between the tapes at some Enduro World Cups this year.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'm excited for that.
Nice one. Cheers, Iago.
Cheers.
All right, that's it for this episode with Iago. I really hope you enjoyed it. A massive thanks to Seven Mesh for supporting this episode of the show. They've just launched their Spring-Summer 2024 mountain bike range on sevenmesh.com, and it features a heap of awesome new colours as well as an updated version of their fan-favourite GlidePath pant, which aims to be your perfect trail riding pant. So if you're ready to elevate your riding experience, then head over to sevenmesh.com, that's the number 7 followed by the word mesh, and use the code DOWNTIMEX7MESH20 to enjoy a generous 20% off. That's DOWNTIME, lowercase x, the number 7, MESH, and the number 20, all one word. But hurry, the offer is only valid until April the 10th, 2024. If you'd like to support the podcast, that could be via a regular donation at patreon.com/downtimepodcast, by grabbing yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop, by sharing the episodes with your friends or online, or by subscribing to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast and sharing the videos some love with likes and comments to help the channel grow. Stay connected by following the podcast. Hit that button in your podcast app now or visit downtimepodcast.com/follow. Don't forget to follow on Instagram and Facebook too, where we're at Downtime Podcast. And for an extra dose of downtime, sign up to our newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter. All right, that's it for today. We're going to have another awesome episode coming up really soon. But until next time, get out and ride.